From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early 1990s in Yugoslavia, which was gripped by violence and political polarization. Many Americans watched those scenes unfold with a kind of detachment. After all, the Cold War was over, and as Francis Fukuyama would later note, Americans were enjoying the first years of a holiday from history, as Fukuyama put it. Extremist violence was something that happened somewhere else. And anyway, when it did happen, it would inevitably be snuffed out by the forces of liberalism and progress. Eventually, democratic institutions would prevail. This week, the United States has mourned the terrorist attack in Buffalo that left 10 people murdered in an act of racist violence. Increasingly, we hear candidates for office threatening actual violence against their opponents. We hear talk of shutting down elections. It's all happening here. Now, this is not Yugoslavia, but neither is this a moment that requires no care or thought to how we go forward. Valerie Perry grew up in Buffalo, but lives now in Bosnia, where she studies political violence and extremism in Europe and Central Asia. She says she increasingly sees similarities in trends when it comes to, for example, white supremacist extremism, both abroad and in the United States. And the gunman in Buffalo is the latest example of how this type of ideology is becoming more mainstream. This hour, we talk with her about her research and what can be done to address this issue head on. Our guest is Dr. Valerie Perry, a researcher and consultant and senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council in Sarajevo. Dr. Perry, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for the invitation.
What time is it where you are? I'm glad that you've made the time for us.
No, it's 7 in the evening, so it's perfect time, actually. It's only 6 hours ahead of the Eastern time zone.
Tell me about your roots in Buffalo.
My roots in Buffalo, well, I grew up in Lancaster, New York, went to public schools there, and basically had a normal childhood in the 70s and in the 80s. And when I finished with high school, where I was a fairly average, normal student in terms of studies and extracurricular activities and camp, et cetera, I decided to go fairly local to the University of Rochester for my undergraduate studies. And my parents remained in Buffalo for some time, but they relocated to Rochester about 20 years ago. So that brings me back there a few times a year.
What has the last week been like for you watching the events, the terrorist attack there?
Sure. No, it's always difficult being an American overseas to suddenly turn on the TV or get an alert on the phone about a mass shooting. And the fact that this one meant that I woke up and heard that it had happened in Buffalo meant that all my friends know I'm from there. And it both leads me to try to make sense of it, but it also leads to questions from my friends in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the region, globally, to always be asking me, you know, why does this keep happening? It's not a one-off. And it's very frustrating as an American living abroad to sort of see people sometimes sort of literally shake their heads and wonder what is going on over there. You know, things might not be perfect in a lot of other countries around the world, but what is this sickness that allows for mass shootings to become, unfortunately, commonplace? And the fact that this one, from the start, had very clear ideological racist motivations that are unfortunately in line with some of the trends we're seeing in terms of racial and ethnically motivated violent extremism, made it really hit home to me professionally, since this is something I've been studying for the past 6, 7, 8 years in particular.
So let me ask you something that is, I think, if I'm not careful, it will risk coming off as callous sort of almost flippant. I don't mean to be that way, but what I want to ask you is, when we think about political extremism and acts of terrorism or political violence or extremist violence, certainly we can talk about a society where there's none of that. In a country with 330 million people, I suspect there will be some acts of violence, you know. The number's probably not zero, I guess, is what I'm saying. But how do we determine, if something has crossed a threshold that tells us this is not some sort of sad occasional fluctuation or an expression of an outlier view that occasionally bubbles up into violence, but it has become something different, something more mainstream, something that could become more common or threatening or destabilizing. How do we determine that, and how close do you see the United States to that, if that makes sense?
No, sure. No, the first thought that comes to mind is what's very frustrating is that whenever one of these incidents happens in the United States, whether it has a clear or perceived ideological motivation, or whether it's just in air quotes, a random act of mass violence, we so often hear people sort of revert to issues of it's a mental health issue. It's related to inequality. It's related to, you know, depressed, unfulfilled young men adjusting to a new educational and professional world, etc. And you can look at all those things, but all of those things are happening in other countries around the world. And yet you very rarely hear about something like this happening. I mean, when we do think of some other places where we've seen mass violence like this, they almost stand out because of their exceptionalism. Whether we look at the shooting by a killer who ended up having ties with the incel movement up in Montreal some years ago, whether we look at the mass shooting that happened in Australia some years ago, which actually led to a substantial overhaul in terms of firearms regulations, we see those because they were very rare. I would make a distinction, and perhaps we'll get to this in the discussion, with a wave of terrorist attacks that had been inspired by ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Europe in 2013, 14, 15, et cetera, which led to a lot of actions on radicalization and police enforcement efforts to try to stop these attacks. We remember what happened in Paris at Bataclan. We remember trucks going through crowds in Nice or in Germany. And these were ideological, and they were motivated by inherence of a violent interpretation of so-called political Islam or Salafist jihadist Islam. But I would put that in a bit of a separate basket from some of what we're seeing in the United States. However, by separating it out, though, I don't want to suggest that the different motivations that lead individuals to commit these acts of terrorism should be seen as fundamentally different, whether or not they're based in ISIS-inspired, Al-Qaeda-inspired ideology versus white supremacist, violent, racially, ethnically motivated violent extremism. I think that there's an awful lot of similarities, and that it really is time to try to look at what these similarities are to get to the individual, but also some of the broader structural and environmental root causes that may be prompting these unfortunate trends.
We'll get to some of those root causes and what is causing those trends. And then, frankly, if there are any sort of mitigating factor solutions, we'll talk a little bit about that with our guest, Dr. Valerie Perry, who is with the Democratization Policy Council in Sarajevo, but has roots right here in Rochester and Buffalo. Dr. Perry, tell people a little bit more about what you do in Sarajevo.
Sure. No, I had been working in Washington, D.C., and working on my Ph.D. When I got the opportunity to come to Sarajevo in 1997, which was about a year and a half, 2 years after the end of the 3.5-year war that killed about 100,000 people and displaced half of the population of the country, around 2 million people. And I had the opportunity to go to serve as a supervisor, an international supervisor, in the first post-war local elections. And because the United States had been quite involved in helping to negotiate an end to the war, the U.S. was also very deeply committed at that time to trying to implement some of the post-war reconstruction, rehabilitation, and democratization processes. And elections were a part of that. And at the time, the aim was to ensure that there'd be at least one international observer in every single polling station in the country to build confidence in the count, to build confidence in the process, and to lend a sense of security. There had been a lot of fears of ballot box stuffing, of pressure against minorities who would come to vote, of improper counting practices, etc. And so by having internationals from the United States, but also from throughout Europe and beyond, there was seen as a confidence building measure. And as I say this, I'm fully aware of the irony that election procedures have now become such a controversial issue in the United States as well, which again leads me to worry about some of the parallels that I see in terms of threats to liberal democracy in polarized societies. But perhaps we can get to that a bit later. But after that first experience, I was fascinated by the country and its people. As you mentioned in the introduction, I, as so many others, we saw this war play out on CNN. We saw Christiane Amanpour and so many other journalists reporting from Sarajevo, the Olympic city under siege. We had heard about, you know, the massacre of almost 8,000 men and boys in Srebrenica. And we followed all of this. And so the chance to go to the country to see how a peace agreement could be implemented, how a society could not only be rebuilt, but built in the way that it would be ready to join the European Union, meet its obligations under the Council of Europe, and perhaps join NATO, was motivating and really inspiring. And so when I went to work on my PhD dissertation, I went to Bosnia to work on that with every intention of returning to Washington within a year, finishing my degree, getting a job at the State Department or a think tank in D.C. And 22 years later, I'm still there. I found the work to be fulfilling and inspiring. I found the people to be fantastic and the culture of social life and the nature to be something that's kept me there. And so I've been happy to be able to stay there.
I want to contrast some of what you wrote to some of what I've been thinking about recently in regards to, and maybe listeners are sick of hearing me invoke Francis Fukuyama, but I've been thinking about not only his work in the end of history, but also some of his recent commentary that he's had about maybe a spirit of 1989. And Fukuyama said recently that he feels that, the end of the Cold War, if you really go to 1991 to 30 years later, a lot of Americans will come to view that as a holiday from history. And there is something really privileged about that. And I acknowledge it because I am one of the chief beneficiaries. I was born in 1979. I did not ever have a day where I went to school and I was taught about, hiding under a desk or getting into a fallout shelter. I mean, that was just, it was never on my mind. I grew up with all kinds of advantages. And so now this is the first time this much destabilization around the world has been sort of rearing its head into, places that seemed impenetrable. And so in that way, I think Fukuyama's framing is effective for a privileged person like me. But what you also write is you remind us that if you go back to the early 90s, even when Americans were kind of looking at Yugoslavia with some detachment and thinking, whatever happens there, that's what happens there. And, it'll fix itself. Here's what you also write this. You write, quote, "Yet those initial giddy years were in reality always sullied by the wars in Yugoslavia, the genocide in Rwanda, the Second Congo War, Great War of Africa, and many other, quote, localized fires. And while the popular discourse in the West was one of democracy and capitalism having prevailed, more sober analysis was emerging from various disciplines," end quote. Are we at a place where we can make any conclusions that certain exuberance was unwarranted and that sustaining that expectation of peace, that trade would lead to peace, that capitalism would lead to peace, that an interconnected globalization would lead to peace? Are all of those things simply wrong or something else happening here, Dr. Perry?
Sure. No, I'm glad you raised Fukuyama because his framing of the end of history was really emblematic of the sense that the West had won, that the notion that liberalism of markets but also politics was really the only game in town, did give people, policymakers in the United States, but also Western Europe and Eastern Europe, which was quickly expanding, a sense of exuberance, a sense of eagerness and optimism, which unfortunately led to a certain amount of hubris and the ability to not see other trends that were developing. In addition to some of the wars that you just referred to in my quote, I mean, I also think that we can look at this end of history in a much more narrow frame. I mean, you can make strong arguments that this notion of the end of history was already obstructed by the attacks of 9/11 and the subsequent global war on terrorism, which got the United States involved geopolitically in what was often very damaging ways throughout the world and really led to some illiberal bedfellows in a number of ways. And then the financial crisis in 2008 would be the next step that I would point out to, which showed again the fact that, which showed again that this arc was never as long as we wanted to think it was, and that there were always a lot more bumps in the road. And there had been critics from early on who recognized that the notion that we could turn a switch and go from the Cold War, from the Soviet Union bipolarity, to a system where all of a sudden free market economies and electoral democracies would just flourish. And it was naive to think that that would happen. But it was easy to do so because at that time, the global bifurcation between the West, led by the United States and NATO, and the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, meant that it was a lot easier to ignore a number of different trends going on domestically in the United States, and enabled a certain amount of centrist unity by various political parties that has been on a consistent decline, unfortunately, since the mid-1990s. And while some of that has to do with some individual politicians from the United States, I don't think we can disconnect that from the massive tectonic shifts that happened in terms of domestic and international politics and relations following the end of the Cold War. And so, unfortunately, what we saw emerge in 2015 with Brexit, with the election of Donald Trump, with a lot of the rise of authoritarian populism globally, was in many ways the culmination of trends that had been building up over the period of time since we had hoped that history had finished.
Can we get then to some root causes of where we are now? Because you point to 2015 and a lot of things happening around the same time, Trump, Brexit, et cetera, and some of the rhetoric that we saw changing in American politics. I don't want to be naive. I mean, I understand when I say changing in American politics, I'm referring to, I think, the weaponization of fear of the other. I mean, it's just been more overt in most of the last decade. And so here we are with a 180-page screed from a white man from New York's Southern Tier who drives several hours. He's concerned about so-called replacement theory, white replacement theory. And he's not just been hearing that on Reddit and 4chan, though he has heard it there. Mm-hmm. He's heard it on Fox News almost nightly. It's become more mainstreamed. You have political figures parroting what used to be sort of dog whistles and code for white nationalists, and now they're just putting them straight out into the open. What, you know, how deeply do these roots go, and how do we then assess what happened in Buffalo can be prevented by XYZ? I mean, it's never that snug, but where do we go from here?
Sure. Now, I think a lot of the issues that you just mentioned would fit into what I would sort of put out there as a framework for an environment in which the attack that happened in Buffalo can happen, and unfortunately has happened, whether we look at places like Christchurch in New Zealand, El Paso in 2019, and a number of other places, or if we just look at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. And what you mentioned, first, I would say, like, ideology does exist, and we've seen a constant development of a basis of ideology, including the Great Replacement, quote-unquote, theory, but also accelerationism and identitarianism, which I know that you had some experts on Monday who discussed this, so I won't go into a lot of detail, but there was fertile ground for this to happen because of the huge shifts that were happening in society in the United States and many other societies related to globalization, related to mechanization, and related to other trends, which suddenly made it much easier for conflict entrepreneurs to build and stoke the notion of loss and grievance, and to build on the static anxiety. And I'm glad you used the word screed instead of manifesto, because what we're seeing is really that those 180 pages were largely plagiarized from other texts by other terrorists, but also included some additional elements of personality from this specific perpetrator. But it's becoming to really be a canon. I mean, we can see that there's a line of connection among these ideologies, among the people who have decided to commit their lives and commit acts of murder for them. You also mentioned the issue of Fox News and other news outlets. I mean, I think we can't discount the impact of having the loss of the 6 o'clock news on three different stations that had a fairly centrist view. I mean, everyone could basically agree back when we would listen to Dan Rather or others give the news that that's what the news was. You know, that's what we were hearing. But then as we moved into 24-hour news, and once we started to see the development of Fox, which had a very different approach in particular to its opinion side, all of a sudden you start to create a different television viewer information bubble. And this bubble was then made even larger by the impact of the internet and social media. And one of your speakers on Monday had noted the fact that technologies have always been used to spread different ideologies, et cetera. But I think that the impact of the internet really can't be discounted, because it allows these disaffected young men, and they tend to be men, to meet each other and to know about each other. I mean, the Unabomber wasn't plugged in with millions of people every day when he was out in his cabin typing. And nowadays, people are finding each other. They encourage each other. They share with each other. And they get one another wound up together. And that's a huge part of radicalization. But then I think one of the really troubling elements in the United States, and you alluded to this as well, is the fact that there are very often real people in positions of power and even officially elected positions who lend either direct or indirect support to some of these thoughts through their own comments. And we've seen this in the past several days. If people have been looking at even like Elise Stefanik from New York itself, mm-hmm. who has been making racist dog whistles about replacement, about immigrants in the past, and is now trying to backpedal. But this creates an environment in which the entire, as we would say, like the Overton window of discourse shifts to the right. And things that were once considered to be unacceptable in the broad social discourse are suddenly normalized, meaning that the extreme becomes more extreme and the center becomes less and less of a center. And all of these things together are bad enough in any society, but then we can add the easy availability of weapons in the United States, and it's really toxic. And
Dr. Perry, can I jump in for one second?
Sure.
I want to give an example of exactly what Dr. Perry is talking about. We've got a clip I want to play. It comes from a man named Joel Altman. He is host of the Conservative Daily podcast. He's a Colorado Republican activist, and he was briefly nominated for governor at the Republican Party's state assembly last month by a member of the state assembly who said he was proud to nominate him. And Nine News Denver and news anchor Kyle Clark put together this compilation of some of Joel Altman's comments about the current governor. So the current governor of Colorado, Jared Polis, is a Democrat. He is very much a centrist Democrat. He has been listed as sort of a middle-of-the-road possible Democratic candidate should Joe Biden not want to run again. He is a gay man who's married, but he is I don't know how palatable that would be to many Republican voters, but he's also kind of a technocratic guy. He's an entrepreneur. He favored lifting COVID restrictions very early. There's nothing all that sort of extreme that stands out about Jared Polis. And Joe Altman, who was briefly nominated for governor, has had this to say about Polis.
You are a traitor. So that's what I sent to Governor Polis. gallows. I had to stretch that rope. I did call for the hanging of traitors, 100%, because traitors to the nation, if you go and look at what happens for treason, it is punishable by death. And so I think they should be hung 2 inches off the ground so they choke to death. It's not fundamentally flawed to talk about hanging treason, treasonous traitors. It's not. What it is it's a fact.
You don't like me talking about the gallows and hanging those that are traitors against our country? Change the law, because it's in the Constitution that you should be hung.
The adequate response for treason is 100% being hung by your neck till you're dead. I don't even care if you're 2 inches off the ground, as long as you can't breathe and you're a traitor to our nation. I said it. Sorry. Vengeance is God's, but consequences belong to us.
That's Joe Altman, a Republican activist in Colorado who was briefly nominated for governor, talking about the current centrist governor, a Democrat named Jared Polis. Is that the kind of rhetoric that you're talking about that's become sort of mainstream here, Dr. Perry?
Yes, and there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, the escalation of rhetoric is completely based on the notion that there is an existential struggle between us and them. Them is the enemy. And this is all a very short step from the idea that the other is an existential threat that needs to be destroyed to ensure the quote-unquote survival of the us. And I wish that these speakers would step back and listen to what they're doing, because they are normalizing this hate. They're normalizing the notion that politics should be resolved by, not by persuasion, but by violence. And unfortunately, I think that this is linked to some of the political spoilers who are making money, who are getting power by spreading this and by getting more clicks online or getting more advertisement, because they're keeping the audience completely jacked up. But I think it's also shows what happens when you have a system in the United States where people pretty much have to vote for a Republican or a Democrat and become so closely tied to their own tribe that they would rather vote for someone who says something like that than the other party. I'm always shocked when I hear someone say, you know, I wouldn't vote for that person because they believe in QAnon, but it's got to be better than the Democrat. And I think to myself, what is going on that has made people attach their well-being and their very identity to a political party in that way, in that fashion, in such a short time? I mean, it's something that's fairly recent in my lifetime, and it's extremely troubling because we're not seeing the appropriate response needed from the government, from the politicians. I had hoped that we would see this after the events of January 6th, but we haven't. And this is what makes me even more troubled.
After we take our only break, we'll talk about whether that parallels some of what Dr. Perry sees in Europe or Central Asia. Dr. Valerie Perry, our guest, who is from Buffalo originally and studied at the University of Rochester and now works as a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council in Sarajevo, joining us from Sarajevo, talking about violent extremism in Europe, in the United States, and the kind that came to Valerie's hometown. We'll talk to Dr. Perry more on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections, talking to a Buffalo native, one of Rochester's leaders, a black man who sees his city as one of a complicated legacy, racism, but yes, hope, but now so much pain. Where do we go from here? We'll talk to Dr. Sean Nelms on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm grateful that Dr. Valerie Perry is sharing her time with us from Sarajevo and taking the time to call the program and spend the hour talking about her research, her understanding of politics and political polarization and extremism and violence in Europe and what we're seeing here. How closely now do you see some resemblances between the United States, Dr. Perry, and some of what you've studied in Europe?
Sure. And Evan, if I could just mention for full accuracy, right now I'm sitting in Croatia.
Oh, Croatia.
Which is just a few hours from Sarajevo. I'm out here for a few days. But it's I'm glad I have a chance to mention that because, and again, before the wars in the early 1990s, Croatia and Bosnia were in the same country, and now they're separate countries. And so you have to cross a border. There's different systems, regimes for everything. And a lot of people lost a lot when Yugoslavia broke up into its separate parts. In terms of what I see, what is very troubling for me is that, again, the fact that the population in the United States is becoming so polarized and so attached to these tribal political identities, red versus blue, MAGA versus whatever the opposite of MAGA is, et cetera, has a lot of parallels with what we've seen in other societies that have experienced the severe political, sectarian, or ethno-national conflict. And while it's very easy to say, well, that could never happen in the United States, trust me when I say that people have said that about the societies where they're from as well. It's very difficult. It was very difficult for a lot of people in Sarajevo to ever imagine that their city would be shelled because they had all lived together, dated each other, listened to the same music, fell in love, traveled together for two generations at least since the end of World War II. And so the notion that suddenly there would be a war to pull people apart was unthinkable. It's very easy for Americans to think, well, it's different. It's Europe. Things are always troubling there. But we need to put that aside because there's always different structural drivers. And the sooner we understand that, the more that we can try to avoid some of those problems. One of the drivers of division are individual leaders who see either a simple personal selfish motivation to build their own power base by stoking this polarization and division without concern of the consequences, or people who have a genuine strong ideological adherence to some belief system. Once they recognize that there's a population of people who feel a certain sense of grievance, who feel that they're unmoored from the life that they thought that they should have or that their parents had had, that feel that they don't have the opportunity to have a job that gives them dignity or meaning, that feels that something is off. As soon as an individual begins creating an other that they can blame as a scapegoat, you start to get into an escalatory spiral of us versus them politics, which is very easy to exploit and very difficult to put back together. We saw this happen in Yugoslavia, but we've also seen this happen in many other conflict zones around the world. And this is why in the United States in particular, I feel that our politicians have a special obligation to begin taking some of the tools that they have been using around the world to promote democratization, to promote good governance, good local governance, independent justice systems, independent media, and start bringing that back home as well. We may have thought that all of these things in the United States were done. I mean, that we didn't need to continue to cultivate these different elements at home, and we could focus on doing it abroad, but we need to do that at home as well. And unfortunately, I fear that we're moving in the opposite direction. I'll stop there for a second. But once we start talking about some of the preventive elements, I'd like to share some thoughts on that as well.
Well, I'm glad you bring this up because there was something that came to mind for me, a conversation I had with a family member not that long ago who has always been just a small C conservative, a lifelong mm-hmm. Republican, joked, would never vote for a Democrat. But has been crestfallen to see what has happened to the Republican Party in recent years and will not talk politics, just is mm-hmm. depressed about it, embarrassed, won't talk about it, you know, still jokes that you're not going to catch me voting for Democrats, but is in a way that I've never seen for decades, just shocked what has happened. This is a person who gave me a gift of Ben Sasse's book and said, Ben Sasse is going to be the next president. And it's going to, you know, Ben Sasse and Jeff Flake and their ilk will pull the Republican Party back from this abyss. And now this family member is saying, I maybe that's not going to happen. Like, so the reason I bring that up is this person has been saying to me, if the political right is going to change, it's got to come from within. It's not going to come from critics from the outside or browbeating from, you know, people in the media or Democrats mm-hmm. or whatever. But how does that happen? So what are the preventive measures, or what are the sort of fixes, and you know, what's the mechanism that makes that happen?
Sure. That's what the million-dollar question is, isn't it? I mean, I agree with your friend who notes that the right needs to change from within. And the fact that there wasn't an effective autopsy on what happened with after Trump's loss, and there hasn't been an effective coming to terms with why what happened on January 6th was so damaging, is highly troubling. And it can't be delinked from the very partisan gerrymandering, which has become part and parcel of American politics, and which, by the way, when Americans engage in trying to work on different election system promotion in countries that have been democratizing, something like that would have been flagged years ago when we were working on democracy promotion. And so there needs to be an honest conversation of that. And I get a little bit of optimism from some of the experiments we're seeing in independent redistricting commissions, but it needs to be far, far more widespread. I think as well, it's been very troubling to see the decline in shared public spaces in the United States, either due to the general impact of changing economies on small town communities, on different suburbs, on different cities, or different public policy decisions to sort of defund community spaces. Because as we have fewer and fewer places that Americans can go to meet someone who's not like them, it makes it easier and easier for a demagogue to other that person and say that they're a traitor, that they're fundamentally different, that they're evil even. And so we need to take back some of that space. And again, this reminds me of work that's been going on by the United States government and others for decades in the post-Cold War period to try to build common local governance community spaces in Bosnia, in Serbia, in Tajikistan, and all of these different places. But now it needs to be done at home. And it can't be done soon enough. I think that, I mean, it's already very clear that the 2022 midterms are going to be very tough. The balance of power in Washington could shift, making it even harder for Biden to push through his agenda. And what worries me is that if that shift happens, it could be very much more related to structural issues rather than an actual popular vote and preference among the American people. But it will also send a lesson to the most extreme politicians in the Republican Party that they did not suffer any negative consequences from their escalation of rhetoric. And so that's something that I think we need to look out for. We can talk perhaps about some of the longer term preventive elements that we might be able to look at in terms of not only preventing more terrorist incidents like we saw in Buffalo, but at the same time try to strengthen liberal democracy. But I just wanted to ask what your reflections are from my response just now.
Yeah, I certainly understand the idea that there's not going to be that the longer we go where there are no consequences for those in power who have either participated in or condoned extremism, violence, etc., the more normalized that becomes. When you talk about January 6th and the idea that for a moment seemed like it was going to be a shake people loose and kind of get back to reality, but and I haven't read all of Jonathan Martin and his colleagues' new book, but there is plenty in there about the absolute spinelessness of people in power. You know, Mitch McConnell didn't get into power because he wanted to hang out and make bedfellows with Donald Trump, but he is willing to do it just to continue to wield power. And for what? It's an amazing sort of set of circumstances. And the longer this goes, the more you have, you know, for example, we had a Republican state senator on this program, a very affable person this week, very generous with his time. But he could not tell me that he thought there was anything wrong with Tucker Carlson saying the Democrats had a secret plan to bring third world obedient immigrants in to replace white voters. I mean, that's absurd, and it's also racist, and it's also demeaning to people who have their own agency. But he can't. And I suspect he does think there's something wrong. But the longer we go now, it's like, You can't question it. I think for a long time, mm-hmm. Dr. Perry, the idea was this will fix itself. We'll get back to more civility. We'll get back to, you know, respecting differences. And I don't know if the monster's out of the lab. I don't know how we pull it back.
No, everything you said, I agree with 100%. And that's why, again, this is also troubling. I think that your assessment of Mitch McConnell and his motivation to stay in government is dead on. When I see either people like Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger willing to speak out against what they see becoming the mainstream voice of their party, I have to give them a lot of credit. I wish we would see more Republicans taking such a stance and recognizing that even if there's this very short-term loss, that hopefully things would improve for them in the longer term, and then the fabric of democracy would also be strengthened. But that's unfortunately going to be something that's a moral choice coming from those individuals. And only the voters can really try to send that signal. It's very necessary for Republicans who are not satisfied with the direction they see, are not satisfied being a voter in a political party that doesn't even have a platform right now because they basically just pledged fealty to Trump in the last election. Those are the people who need to step out and start supporting more moderate candidates. And I think that as we're seeing the primary season unfold, unfortunately, this is not always happening. And again, the notion of politics having become a form of almost entertainment designed to enrage and designed to stoke anger means that we're ending up seeing candidates who have no real interest in actual public service arise to the top just so they can build their brand and stoke this anger. And that won't be good for the long term. I would argue that the United States again, would benefit from another one of the democracy elements that we've been exporting for about 30 years, which is, again, a high-quality civic education. And unfortunately, civic education has been on the decline in the United States for years, with a lot of students barely getting anything at all. And so maybe we shouldn't be surprised that we've got a generation of people who haven't really seen themselves as a part of a community, who haven't recognize that votes based on policy should be preferable than votes based on tribal identity or just trying to own the libs. But we're not seeing that. And we really need an investment into democracy in the United States if we want to turn this around.
Let me get a little bit of feedback from listeners. And this is Robert in Fairport first on the phone with Dr. Valerie Perry. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yeah, this sounds like about a half hour, 45 minutes of Republican bashing. I don't see any talk of any similarity here on how the whole abortion issue has been treated. It's practically a sacrament here in New York State, but it's not in other states. And you got politicians like Chuck Schumer going out there and getting people riled up and having people protest at Supreme Court justices' houses and stuff like that.
I think we're
pretty close to a situation where one of these justices is going to get shot at some point.
No, that I hear. I mean, so let me say to Robert's point there, I understand there are going to some listeners don't, you know, agree with this. But I am not a fan of seeing people protest outside the personal residences of just about anybody. And someone is going to email me and say, hey, straight white guy, like, read the room. It's easy for you to say. But I do think there are norms that are not just, you know, sort of there for academic reasons. I think what Robert is talking about, you know, you go down a road that feels really fraught when there is not only that much anger, but you start showing up, you know, when someone's kids are getting home from school and you got a large group of people screaming outside their house. That does not feel comfortable or wise to me, but I don't know how Dr. Perry feels. What do you think?
No, I mean, I understand. I think that the fact that public service is losing a lot of public servants because of the pressure, either online or in person at restaurants, et cetera, is worrisome because that means we won't be getting the best people into public service. So I can completely understand that. And I think the entire debate on abortion has also become such a polarizing and weaponized tool that it can't be disentangled from this broader polarization in American society in general. And I think that this leak of the ruling of the Supreme Court will be further damaging in terms of trust in the justice system, which is a necessary pillar of any democratic society, and again is something that the United States has been working to support overseas for decades, trying to build a trusted judicial system that works and delivers blind justice without regard to what party you're in and what tribe you're in, what group you're in. And I worry that we're on the verge of losing that as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear Robert saying sounds like Republican bashing. This is not intended to be a partisan conversation. This is an analysis of a current political moment. It's possible that 5-10 years from now, we talk to Dr. Perry and the existential threat to the democratic institutions are coming from the political left. They just don't happen to be right now in this country. And they're being stoked for sort of crass gain by those on the right who might not realize that, you know, they are condoning the kind of thing that could bring down their own power structures. But this was not intended to be a partisan conversation, Dr. Perry.
No, exactly. No, I agree. I agree with you completely. And I think it's important to recognize that the reason there is more responsibility on the side of the Republicans today in the United States is precisely because Trump was able to basically take over that party and make it his own in a way that has really been based more on a cult of personality as opposed to any agenda. And again, I would point to the fact that there was no Republican Party platform in the last presidential election. You don't need to look much further to recognize that that's basically a cult of personality. But you're right that the ideal system of governance would be one in which it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat, black or white, male or female, rich or poor, but you would feel the system is working for you. Whether or not it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party that is playing a more actively polarizing role. And we need to be thinking not just about today or October 2022, but about the system in 5, 10, and 20 years. And unfortunately, we often don't think long term in that way.
So let's start to wrap with a couple of points here. So much of what gives me some despair is the fact that some of what you're talking about is not a reversible thing. We're not going to have a society that is not ultra connected by the internet. We talked about the shooter in Buffalo and how easy it is now, how difficult it was in Ted Kaczynski's time, but now how easy it is to find common thoughts, share ideas, share all kinds of awful things that lead to the kind of violence we saw in Buffalo. That's not going away. And you've got craven political actors who know that the angrier that they can get people, the more aggrieved they make people feel, the more they try to stand to gain politically. And, you know, we can try to resist that one by one, but in 1976, when Jimmy Carter was elected, only 20% of Americans lived in landslide counties. You know, counties where there was a big political win over the other. And now it's almost 2/3 of Americans. We don't even live near neighbors who think differently, let alone look differently, worship differently, et cetera. So the prescription starts with what, Dr. Perry? I mean, there's not one easy step here, but what's the first step?
Sure. No, I would start out by saying that, again, in the last presidential elections, the majority of Americans voted against a continuation of the previous administration. That doesn't mean that a lot of people didn't vote for it, but the majority were against that. And so that is a good thing. And that is something that we need to hold on to. I think that, again, that democracy is always built from the bottom up. And so a recommitment of good people running for election in local government, municipal government, et cetera, is key. And in getting involved in communities, recognizing that active citizenship is something that's necessary and indispensable for a functioning society to work and for people to be more than consumers, but to really be citizens. Civic education is critical, and this is why I'm extremely troubled by the entire CRT debate and the fact that it looks like the United States could actually be weakening its media literacy, its critical thinking skills, and its social and emotional learning at precisely the time that we need more critical thinking citizens. And so I hope that something good will come out of the churn we're seeing right now. And I think as well that so many of the divisive trends that we're seeing in the media are coming from the big, you know, Sinclair, One American News, the Fox Opinion side, etc.
After all that, after one wonderful hour with Dr. Perry, 30 seconds from the finish line, the call from Croatia dropped. So that's my cue to tell you that you've been listening to Dr. Valerie Perry, who is a researcher and consultant and a senior associate for the Democratization Policy Council based in Sarajevo. That's where she does most of her work, joining us this hour from Croatia, taking the time to get in touch with us because she's got roots in Buffalo. She's from Buffalo, and she studied at the University of Rochester and actually reached out to Connections to say, thought it would be a valuable time to come on and talk about how her work in Europe, in Eastern Europe, feels some reflections into what she's seeing, not only in the attack in her hometown, but in her native country. So we very much appreciate the time from Dr. Valerie Perry this hour. I want to stress again, we kind of talked about it at the end of the hour. This stuff is not supposed to be partisan. If you support people who are different, if you support free expression, if you support free elections, if you want to have diverse places and support people thinking the way they want to think, and you don't need everyone to vote the same, that's all we want. That's great. That is wonderful. Different is good. Different can be beautiful. Our thanks to Dr. Perry and the whole team here at Connections. Thank you for listening. We're back with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.